guys, welcome to another episode of Textree. Today we have something really interesting. I'm really excited about this. But before we dive into it, make sure to check out patreon.com/textree for Textree related stuff and to support the podcast to make sure it's coming out. So today we're talking about the first advice column in history. It was called the Athenian Mercury. And it was, let's say, a paper that was published twice a week from 1690 to 1697 by John Dunton. John Dunton was a bookseller, he was a writer, he was English, but he had a brief US chapter where he visited the New World. Then later he got in financial trouble, then he escaped to Holland, so a lot of stuff happened in his life before he eventually returned to England. And then he was like, you know what, I need something cool to do, like I'm kind of bored. So he founded a society with some of his friends. And it wasn't a society in which they actually did a lot of stuff because this society mostly existed so he could publish a new journal, the Athenian Mercury, that was following this really unusual Q&A formula. So he was practically one of the first, if not the first people, to invent this formula of readers asking questions and then the journal answering those questions. So theoretically, the members of the society would be consulted on some of the answers because the questions varied. There were a lot of different categories. So as members, he had a philosopher, he had a clergyman, he had a mathematician, and that's all. There were four members, and then he made up a lot of fictional members to make it seem like this society was very professional, you know, the answers were legit. But to be fair, he was doing most of the answers. Like, he was sometimes consulting other people, but most of the time it was his writing. And, you know, they had a reputation, and the society had a reputation to uphold because this format got really popular. People were loving the idea of sending in questions and then getting sophisticated answers. And it really shows that they were asking about everything and anything that came to their minds. So they were ranging from philosophy, you would have biblical themes, you would have questions about relationships, you would have questions about physics, about astronomy and stuff like that. I'm going to focus on relationships and social norms because I found them the most interesting, but some of the questions were like, so what was the height of the Babel Tower? Was that a real serpent that seduced Eve? What causes wind? Is sun made of fire? So I think it's also just looking through these questions, it's a great insight into a 17th century person's head, because obviously they were preoccupied with different topics than we are nowadays. But one topic that I think remains popular in those Q&A formats or advice column formats is, of course, relationships. So we're going to read that. I'm actually surprised at how forward some of these questions are, but also, again, it's a theme that keeps coming back and back in this podcast, but how similar the thoughts that they had on relationships and the doubts that they had about relationships are to what we're talking about in these types of advice columns. So let's jump into it. Question: whether a friendship contracted by single persons may continue with the same zeal and innocence if either marry? See, just this question to me is fascinating because I think when most of us think of the old ages and in this case 17th century, we don't particularly imagine men and women being friends. We think men only saw them as objects. We think women only saw men as a chance for a better life. We think everyone was very transactional with their relationships. We think that women were forced by their parents to marry whoever the parents wanted, and they just lived very sheltered lives. But that's maybe a 19th century myth, because it is true that women's situation in 17th and 18th centuries in many ways was much more progressive than what happened later in the 19th century, where women were sort of designated homemakers, because that was not necessarily the case In previous centuries, especially for working class women, they could own businesses, they could work, a lot of the lifestyle was about going to other people's houses. Women were, I want to say, very independent, but maybe a bit more active, or at least they retained a lot more control over their lives. Of course, it's difficult to measure like how free women were in 17th century versus the 19th century, but I think a lot of it comes down to like the social sentiment and the views of people at the time. And as you will see, not all people in 17th century thought that all that a woman is good for is just sitting at home and having babies and that she doesn't even have a brain. Versus, let's say, a lot of Victorian thinkers did actually think and write that. So I think we think of women's rights as a sort of linear progress that happened over the centuries, but the truth is it kept going back and forth a lot. And I think this is a good example of that. So I went on a bit of a tangent here. So let's get back to the question, which was whether a friendship contracted by single persons may continue with the same zeal and innocence if either marry. Answer: it may, though 10 to 1 if it does. Since in those circumstances, there will be a great hazard that either the innocence will spoil the zeal, or the zeal the innocence. Not but that there is a great deal depends on the characters of the persons concerned. A friendship may perhaps be innocent where 'tis not safe, but hardly either long in this case, unless between those of great prudence and virtue, since 'tis oftentimes only a pretense, and as such one of the most dangerous things in the world. In the meantime, as generosity may be criminal, so suspicion is base. And one infallibly ruins friendship, as the other may virtue and honor, though a prudent caution may perhaps be a medium between both. For either there must be more or less tenderness for the friend than for the wife or husband. If more, 'tis injustice, for people ought not to marry any but such as are fit to make friends. If less, the former friendship must be diminished, as if the marriage be happy, it generally, perhaps always, is. So all these nuances of friendships between men and women are probably not something that we would expect from a 17th century journal, but it 100% is something that could appear in like Cosmopolitan or something, you know, in an advice column. And that's something that gets me, because a lot of these questions and answers, if we rewrote them to sound more modern, I don't think people would be able to tell that they're that old. Whether it is lawful to make addresses to young ladies without a prior acquainting their parents and relatives therewith. Okay, this one's a little different because this type of courtship does not really happen anymore. We don't need to be formally introduced to someone before we start courting them. It probably helps. Like, a lot of people meet someone through their friends or family, but it's also possible to just walk up to someone in the streets. And back then, it was probably not as common, especially in someone that was of like noble background. So here is the answer. To speak strictly, no contract can be justly made with any but such as are sui iuris. Okay, this means of age. So first off, he's like, they need to be of age, which is, again, it seems like a progressive take for someone in 1690s. A general conversation with a lady is requisite to know, if possible, whether she deserves to be loved. And this before any application be made to the parents for liberty for a formed courtship, which, were I a lover, I should choose to make as near as possible both to young and old at the same time, that neither might conceive any umbrage of each other. So he's like, if you can talk to the lady first to make sure if she's even worth courting, do it. But also, you should ask the parents for a permission as soon as possible, just so you're on the same page and everything is clear. Which, again, is surprisingly solid advice for 1690s. Question: whether it is lawful to marry a person one cannot love only in compliance to relations and to get an estate? Again, a very modern problem of marrying someone for money. Answer: Had the question only been proposed of such as we don't actually love, it might perhaps have admitted of some limitation, since we sometimes see persons love tenderly after marriage, who could hardly endure each other's sight before. Though even such an experiment must be very dangerous and hazardous, and he must be a bold man who dares venture upon it. But as 'tis proposed here, whether we may marry such as we cannot love, 'tis beyond doubt, and must be answered negative, since such a practice would be both the most cruel and imprudent thing in the world. Okay, John's pen is on fire here. Society is the main end of marriage. Love is the bond of society, without which there can neither be found in that state pleasure or profit or honor. He then or she that marry for so base an end as profit, without any possibility or prospect of love, is guilty of the highest brutality imaginable, is united to a carcass without a soul. Ooh, burn! That's crazy to say that. Being in a loveless marriage where you did not love the person before you entered the marriage and where you got some sort of financial profit off of it is being united to a carcass without a soul. That's rough. But then he drops the line of the 17th century, man. This being also but too general a truth, as one wittily observes, that he who marries a woman he could never love will, 'tis to be feared, soon love a woman he never married. That's crazy. But also, yeah, it makes sense. Wow. Question. What course must a person take to remove a lady's aversion to him, supposing her under some secret pre-engagements? So this is basically the 17th century equivalent of, I really like this girl, but I think she may have a boyfriend. What do I do? Answer. A pre-engagement of that nature is so sacred a thing that though a lover sticks at nothing to obtain his desires, no man in his sober reason ought to contribute anything towards the breaking it. On which account it would scarce be honest to give directions for the attempting it. Wow, he really shut him down. He was like, if she loves another man, it's none of your business, step away. But the question be simply, how to conquer a lady's aversion, that indeed admits of a fair answer. The best way I know of is, after having found her humor, to ply her clothes, don't let her, if possible, so much as sleep, which they say will tame the wildest creature in the world. Or if she does, be so often with her that she can dream of nothing but you. Bruh. So he's like, no, if she's committed to another man, you can never do anything to separate them. But also, if she doesn't like you, you can basically force her to like you by spending as much time with her as possible and never letting her go. I hope you liked my advice. But also, it reminds me of stories of our grandparents and great-grandparents where the grandma is like, yeah, I really didn't like this guy, but he just kept pestering me so much and so often that I just gave up. And then we got married. Which, like, it doesn't sound as romantic as you think it does, Granny. This only receipt has the greatest effect on the most of the fair sex, yeah, because they can't do anything else, who, if you hold on long enough, will be forced, at last, to love you in their own defense. What the hell? Using you as they do beggars, give you an alms to be rid of you, for to speak truth of our own lewd sex, there are few of us, when once loved, who love long after. Okay. There is a hint in this advice, I think, of do you really want it to look that way? Yes, you can force her to succumb and maybe potentially marry you, but do you want to be treated as an unwanted man? But also, this one's actually a little scary. This one's quite scary, I have to say. Question: whether most persons do not marry too young? Answer: some are young longer than others and would perhaps never come to tears of discretion, though they lived to be 100 years old. 'Tis hardly anything but want of discretion can make persons deeply unhappy in a married state. And there being so many unhappy marriages, and that virtue being generally owing to age and experience, we may thence indeed conclude most persons marry too young. Discretion in this context obviously means like wisdom, I would say. But supposing that sufficiently perfect, regards too is to be had to the body as well as mind. In both cases, some being at the same years much more vegete than others. So he's saying in age gaps, your bodies might be mismatched, which is partially true because, you know, back then relationships were mostly about procreating. And if your partner is older, there might be fertility issues that can cause a drift in that marriage. Both extremes are bad in this case, as in all others. 'Tis a little of the soonest for infants to get them wives among their other playthings, and much of the latest for old folks to limp into their bridal beds when only fit for their winding sheets. That's brutal. Though on the whole, I don't look upon marrying too soon to be the vice of this age, wherein 'tis so hard a matter to persuade people to marry at all. That's interesting. I didn't think they would have a problem with people wanting to marry, because obviously I thought that was like the end goal for everyone in 17th century. But apparently maybe they were actually rethinking that back then. And he noticed that as a sort of societal shift. Question: whether the woman's condition in marriage be not worse than the man's? Answer: that's much as she manages it. So it's up to her. If it's worse, it's probably her fault. Nature has generally given the fair sex art enough, if that don't look like a contradiction, by which if either she herself or custom or law has given ours any advantage, they may, if they please, recover more than their own agent. Wait, what? Okay, I can't find the word agent in any dictionary, and if I do, it's like Old English, so I think it may have been some sort of typo here. But what he's saying is, yes, maybe we as men have advantages, and maybe the law is on our side, and maybe the customs hate women, but also it's all down to how you deal with it. So this is kind of toxic positivity in a way. But then he says, in childbirth only, they have without doubt much the heavier part of the load now as of the curse formerly. What is he talking about? I don't understand this whole answer. And they have much more reason to wish the world might propagate like trees than man has to desire any such thing. Though one of our sex first started that odd whimsy. I'm a bit confused with this one, not gonna lie. But it's interesting that he's like, no, you're fine. You're good. Ladies, it's all in your head. Question: whether most matches in this age are not made for money, and whether they are not generally Smithfield bargains. So a Smithfield bargain was basically a marriage of convenience where it really mattered what the other person was bringing into the marriage financially. Answer: I don't admire the humor of those who either to show their wisdom or ill nature are always railing at the present age and admiring the former. Wow. I mean, this again, this is something that someone could say nowadays, being like, why do you always complain about modernity and fantasize about the past? The past is the past. Let's focus on now. And therefore affirm that both in this age and all others since the golden one, if any can tell where to find that, 'tis gold has been the truest philtrum to procure love, or at least the chain that has tied persons together without it. But then, that marriages thus made may be properly styled Smithfield bargains is, I think, a mistake. For there, you see your horse rode about. I think Smithfield Bargains was basically like a horse market. For there, you see your horse rode about, see all his paces at least, if not all his humors. And yet more, if you are not a fool of a jockey, will see his saddle taken off before you buy him. But when you marry a wife, you're a servant. Also, I mean, the old age analogy of buying an animal and having to sort of test it beforehand as an analogy to marriage is kind of disgusting. But then we have an interesting question. Question whether if females went a-courting, there would not be more marriages than now there are. Answer. I'm apt to think not so many, at least if they only were to court and we to be silent. For as courage is the more proper virtue of a man, so modesty is of a woman, though we meet with them sometimes in the contrary sexes. For which reason many ladies would die sooner than stoop to what they think so mean a practice, as we have had instances of some who have actually done it. Like, died? No, probably flirted with men. Which is so valid, I would rather die than pursue a man that does not want me. And I would have to do like the flirting, the asking out, no. Put me in a nunnery, I don't care. But there is yet more in it than this. 'Tis their interest, as well as their inclination, to be, I won't say only passive, but on the defensive. For whether or no they'll be so ingenious to confess it, 'tis certain that most men slight even what they find loves them. Much more would they do so should they easily obtain it. Most of all, should it be professed and almost forced upon them. Okay, so men are so insecure that if a lady told them she loved them, they would be like, that's disgusting. Yeah, I actually hate you. I wanted to conquer you myself and now I'm not gonna. Whether a woman may be believed when she says she'll never marry. Yes, as long as she keeps her word and longer than that you'll hardly believe a man. Huh? Moving on. Question. Whether 'tis convenient for a lady to marry one she has an aversion for in obedience to her parents. Now, this is the one I was really interested to hear the answer to, because if this question was asked in the 19th century, the answer would 100% be, you should listen to your parents, they know what's good for you, you're too young to decide, you probably think this guy is bad for you, but they know better, he's probably great, you have to make sacrifices, you know, you're gonna make a good wife. But then here, he says, answer, parents are not to dispose of their children like cattle, nor to make them miserable because they happened to give them being. Question. How shall a man know when a lady loves him? Answer. First find out, if you can, whether she has ever loved any other before. For that renders the case much more difficult. For one that has been deceived herself knows how to deceive you. Okay, Mr. Paranoid. Jealousy is counted one pretty sure sign of love, but I think it much such another as convulsions are of life. Okay. If a woman tells you she loves, there is no way but believing her. Indeed, there are hardly any of the tokens of that passion but are fallible, though the shroudest sign that a woman loves ye is her marrying you. Okay, anxious attachment. I mean, she told you she loves you, so like, she wants to marry you and you're still paranoid about this. I mean, listen. It's 1690s. There was a small chance that she actually needed the money you have, because otherwise she would perish. So there is also that. But why not focus on the positives? And then we have sort of like the other side of this story. Question. What way shall a shamefaced virgin take to let a person know she loves him? Answer. If the lady who proposes his question has either hands or eyes, she need not be taught how to use them, unless her spark is a fool or blind or never leads her. Listen, this is useless advice. It's like asking people how to flirt and they're like, you just have to do it. Or asking people what kissing is like and they're like, I don't know, you just have to try it, it just comes naturally. No, it doesn't. Or when you're single and you're asking your friends, like, how do I even find someone I like? And they're like, it just happens when the time is right. Like, no, that's bullshit. advice. It's not helping at all. If it was gonna happen on its own, it would have happened long time ago. Okay, last one, and it's controversial. Question: whether marriages of persons underage are lawful. The reason of this question being an observation of the ill success of such marriages. Answer: for the question, we must consider those two terms, underage and lawful. 1 and 20 is the age appointed by the laws of our nation. What? Oh my god, 1 and 20, like 21, I'm sorry. 21 was when you were considered of age in 17th century, because I would have assumed it's like 15. That's interesting. So again, 1 and 20 is the age appointed by the laws of our nation, supposing a guardian, etc. Though the law of nature has perhaps fixed a far shorter limit. I'm kind of disappointed that he did not refer to the second part of the question, which was talking about the lack of success, let's say, of people marrying very young. He just completely dropped that. But anyway, this is the sort of advice that 17th century folks were waiting for in their favorite journal, and they were probably sitting around on a Monday being like, oh my god, it's only 2 days until Athenian Mercury comes out. And I think that's so cute, because I love imagining our ancestors as people that were excited about something. But also, I love how this gives you an insight into the doubts that they had, into the thoughts that they had. It's kind of like reading a diary, but probably even better, because a diary could be found, so you could still redact it somehow, so it doesn't show you in a bad light. Sending in these questions anonymously was the only chance these people had to express their thoughts and concerns and doubts. So this is pretty freaking cool, if I dare say so myself. There is a lot more interesting questions that I had to skip. There was one question about, is it true that when pregnant women long for fruits, the one fruit that they want to have is then somehow imprinted on the child's body? Which, what the ever loving heck? Like, you're getting a newborn and you're like, oh my god, is that a mango on his arm? I just find it so funny. So a lot of the questions were actually hilarious. There were astronomical questions that were just completely wrong and off. And then there were a lot of questions about the Bible, trying to sort of make sense of the Bible versus science, which I find really interesting. So you can find Athenian Mercury online if you want to have a look through some of the issues. And I highly recommend that. The font is not easy to read, but it's such an interesting and fascinating document, just showing us what 17th century folks were into. So let me know what you thought about this episode. I'll hear you in another one. And don't forget to check out patreon.com/textory for textory related content. Bye.